Oh, don't we all want to be surrounded by remarkable people? One piece to building relationships with them is recognizing when they come across our radar screens. In this episode, Guy Kawasaki on some of the key indicators for noticing remarkable people. This is Coaching for Leaders, episode 671.
Produced by Innovate Learning, maximizing human potential.
Greetings to you from Orange County, California. This is Coaching for Leaders, and I'm your host, Dave Stachowiak. Leaders aren't born, they're made. And this weekly show helps you discover leadership wisdom through insightful conversations. You know, one of the things that I think we all want in our lives and in our professional relationships is the ability to know, be connected with, and be influenced by remarkable people. And being able to recognize those folks, to learn from them, to be inspired by them, I think is the hallmark of a great leader. Today, I'm honored to have a guest with us who himself is a remarkable person. Perhaps even more importantly, though, is so gifted at having built remarkable relationships with so many, of recognizing people and continuing to learn and grow from them. I'm so pleased to introduce Guy Kawasaki. He is the chief evangelist at Kava and the creator of Guy Kawasaki's Remarkable People podcast. He's an executive fellow of the Haas Business School at UC Berkeley and an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales. He was the chief evangelist at Apple and a trustee of the Wikimedia Foundation. He has written Wise Guy, The Art of the Start 2.0, The Art of Social Media, Enchantment, and 11 other books. He's now the author of Think Remarkable, 9 Paths to Transform Your Life and Make a Difference. Guy, what a pleasure to have you.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Dave.
I'm starting this conversation where you started the book, and it's with Apple. Back in the late 90s, you're back at Apple. You are sitting in the room with Steve Jobs, and the ad agency comes and presents the copy for the Think Different campaign. And I'm going to read it for those who don't know it. Here's ad copy from Think Different. Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. But the one thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward. And while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius, because the ones who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world are the ones who do. One could argue, given Apple's trajectory since then, that is the best ad copy ever written. And I think that one of the reasons that resonated so well is that so many of us are inspired by remarkable people, and we want to be influenced by them, and we want to have a connection to them, don't we?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that the people that you are keeping company with are the people who influence you. And I would also maybe sound harsh, but I think that lousy people tend to bring you down rather than you bring them up. So you should always try to hang out with remarkable people.
Yeah, indeed. And the thing that I think is so brilliant about the book is you have looked at your life experience, of course, studying, having relationships with so many people, and you've really identified and laid the groundwork for us of how do you recognize people who are remarkable and what are they doing? And one of the things you point out is that they reflect back to childhood. And you write, remarkable people often recount their childhood experiences in order to explain where they ended up. What's significant about that?
Well, what's significant about that is that you are cognizant of how you got to where you are. And that is a big barrier to this entitlement syndrome. People with the entitlement syndrome, they don't remember where they came from. They think all of a sudden they're it and they deserve it and the world revolves around them. So I tell the story. I come from a lower middle class part of Honolulu. And if it wasn't for a sixth grade teacher convincing my parents to put me in a private school that led to me getting into Stanford, that led to me getting hired at Apple, I would not be a guest on your podcast today. And so that, you know, I remember that it's because of that sixth grade teacher. You know, that was a pivotal moment in my life.
It made a difference. And it, I think it's interesting of like, there's an element there of humility that a remarkable person has of like, I didn't do this myself. I'm not the lie that some people tell themselves, a self-made woman or a self-made man. It is a community. It's humility that got me here in part.
Yeah. I mean, success has many mothers and fathers, but the concept of a totally self-made person, I guess, is possible, but I think it's not optimal. And behind every self-made person, I'm sure there are remarkable people who helped along the way. And it could be a teacher, a coach, a parent, a friend. People don't become remarkable in a vacuum. And that's an important concept, that you're not born remarkable. You become remarkable.
Which is a good lead-in to one of the points you make really strongly in the book, is that remarkable people don't find their passions, they develop them. And I think a lot of times we hear the message, well-intended, find your passion. And you write, find is the wrong word because it implies that once you find something, the process is over. Truly, you develop your passions. It's rarely love at first sight. You see that often with remarkable people, don't you?
Yes, all the time. And I think that this emphasis in modern American society on finding your passion is a mistake. It sets the fence too high. It's an inaccurate portrayal of how life works. And it's as if that, you know, you're 19 years old, you're applying to college. How can you have not found your passion yet? You haven't started a not-for-profit to help poor people. You haven't built a school in Africa yet. You haven't won a MacArthur Fellowship or a Nobel Prize yet. You know, what's wrong with you? And so people are like hunting for this passion. And my recommendation is that instead of being on this quest for a passion, you just keep an open mind and you do a lot of sampling and you find things that interest you. And when you find something that interests you, you scratch that itch. And thank you, God, that if you scratch enough itches, someday you may discover your passion. But until then, just chill out and just do a lot of sampling.
You've interviewed a lot of people who have done this, who have followed that path, scratched an itch, right? Found the next one. Who inspires you on this? That, you know, has really been on a great journey of developing their passion?
Well, by far, the people in my book and the people in my podcast who you just sort of have to scratch your head and say, you know, how did they do this? I mean, it's inconceivable to me, some of these stories. And the book is about thinking remarkable and about remarkable people. It's not about rich people or famous people. Okay, we need to make that straight. There are no hedge fund managers in my book or my podcast. And I think some of the most dramatic stories are people who grew up in the projects, both parents crack addicts, parents stealing from their kids. The kids, they had to move 30 times during their youth. Another artist who is arguably the next Jean-Michel Basquiat, sentenced at 16 to something like 40 years of prison for a murder he did not commit and wasn't an accessory to. He's in prison for 22 years. He's released. And now he's a thriving artist. I mean, he's completely, completely seized the day. And when you read stories like that, you think, oh, what am I complaining about? And so, believe it or not, I'm deaf. And the only reason why we can do this podcast is because of the miracle of a cochlear implant. and I'm a podcaster like you, and let's just say that being a deaf podcaster is not ideal. And when I tell people this, some of them are just amazed that I can be a podcaster and public speaker while deaf. But then I hear these stories of both parents, crack addicts, prison 22 years. Another woman, she got diagnosed with ALS 10 years ago. Usually people die after 2 years. She got diagnosed and she decided to complete a marathon in all 50 states. So when you hear those kind of stories, you think, what's the big deal about being deaf? And I think that's a good attitude if you want to be remarkable. You cannot wallow in your mire.
Yeah, it's really, the woman you mentioned, I forget her name in the book, who did all the marathons with ALS. It's just an extraordinary story. And I was struck by a couple of the indicators that you mention in the book on how do you notice people who are developing those passions? And one of them is they maybe studied something academically, but they're working in an unrelated role or an unrelated industry, and they're willing to change industries. They're willing to change functions. They're willing to try new stuff. It's often the hallmark of someone who's open to doing that, of developing and finding and learning and growing, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there is no better description of a growth mindset than for people to have started on one path and then change completely. It shows an open-mindedness. It shows the ability to embrace vulnerability, because when you try something new, typically you're not that good when you start at it. So it might affect your self-image, your public image. You have to push past that. One of the stories I tell is, because I never heard this before, but Julia Child started as a copywriter for a furniture store in New York. Then she went to work for the organization that became the CIA. So basically, Julia Child was a spook until her 30s. And then she moved to France and fell in love with French cooking. So she went from copywriter to spook to French chef, television star, author. And I mean, can there be any more proof of the growth mindset than someone who would do something like that?
Indeed. Related to that, you say remarkable people make themselves indispensable. And you write, do what nobody else wants to do. Do whatever is necessary, no matter how unappealing. It is a great way to show that you're valuable and to separate yourself from the pack. And I think back to all the folks whose careers I've watched, Guy, over the years, and the leaders who move up and do lots of really cool things. Oftentimes, they are people who have worked across the organization, across different functions. They have jumped in when something needed to be done. They really have made themselves indispensable.
Yes, and let's give credit to where credit is due. I came upon this wisdom with an interview with Andrew Zimmern. Andrew Zimmern, he had that TV series, Bizarre Foods, where he goes all over the world eating stuff that, let's just say, most people wouldn't eat. And I was asking him about his career. He grew up in Minnesota. So apparently in his teenage years, he was, he had some issues with drugs and stuff. And he cleaned himself up, and he actually was an intern at three different companies at once, one of which was the TV station. And one of his mentors told him that, if you want to get ahead in life, you become indispensable. And the way you become indispensable is that you are willing to do things that others don't want to do. And so you become very valuable at some function. And pretty soon the organization can't do without you. And he actually got three job offers out of three internships, which got to be some kind of record. And that's why we know who Andrew Zimmern is today.
Yeah. The mindset there is so powerful, of being able to do that in whatever role you find yourself in, even if it's not the one you wanted. And you also have this point that remarkable people aren't trying to save the world, which is counterintuitive in a way when you think about it. But you write, remarkable people don't usually start with grandiose plans of crushing or dominating the universe. They start with small and simple questions that over time yield the result of making a difference. That is counterintuitive, isn't it?
Well, it may be counterintuitive, but it's realistic. And yeah, oftentimes, yeah, if you look at Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, you think, oh, these people, they're so remarkable. When they were two guys in a garage, they had this whole plan for Apple that we'd have Apple One, Apple Two, Apple Three, Lisa, Macintosh, iPad, iPhone, iPod, retail stores, Genius Bars, App Store. And, you know, they had this grand plan. But the reality is Steve Wozniak, he was building an Apple One because he wanted a personal computer, not a computer you had to work for the government or a university or a large company. He wanted something small and cheap and easy to use. He didn't have this grand plan of, you know, worldwide domination, trillion-dollar company. He just wanted to make a computer he could use. Fortunately for him and Steve, there are lots of people who also wanted personal computers. And so I think you do yourself a disservice if, you know, you sit down and you see these moguls and these extremely successful people and you think, oh, look at how much they dominate. I need to come up with a dominating plan like that. And the answer is no, you don't. You really don't. You just start small. To use another cooking analogy, don't try to boil the ocean. Just boil the pot and then get a bigger pot and then get more pots. But don't start with the ocean.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, and I think I see this in leadership development too, Guy. Like the programs, the development processes that people do that try to do lots of things at once to shift folks' behavior. You follow up 2-3 months later, a year later, and a lot of times people aren't doing a lot differently. But if you zero in on one thing to shift behavior on, it's interesting, like there's something powerful about just one thing at a time, focusing on something small, taking a small step behaviorally. It just, it gets us farther in the long run. It's counterintuitive, but it's just, like you said, it's reality.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, let's face it. If you decide you want to have worldwide domination, well, odds are you're going to fail. And then where are you? But if you just decide, I'm going to make a computer, I'm going to make this device, I'm going to change one life, I'm going to change one classroom, or my sixth grade teacher, she changed my life. I'm just one speck of dust in the universe. She didn't decide to become Secretary of Education. She just convinced Guy's parents to put him in a private school. And that's why I am where I am. And so I think, to use a surfing analogy, one day, let's say you have a growth mindset and you decide, listen, I play tennis, I play basketball, I want to try a new sport, I'm going to go try surfing. And so step number one is not to go to Mavericks or Pipeline or Nazare and get on a board and try to surf a 100-foot wave. The way you start surfing is you get a really long, thick, stable board and you find an instructor and you go to some place where the waves are 1 to 2 feet. That's how you start. You don't go for a 100-foot wave. You don't even go for a 10-foot wave. You go for a 1-foot wave. And you go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. That's actually where I stopped. But, you know, but the way you get to a 100-foot wave is through the 1-foot wave.
Yeah. The path to being remarkable in a way is unremarkable. It's simple. Yeah. It's small, right?
I love that. Sure. I wish I thought of that. Yeah, the path to being remarkable is unremarkable. It's really paved with grit and growth.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of maybe being a bit unremarkable, is you point out that people who are really remarkable, one of the practices they have is they've got a routine, especially how they start their day. They do things the same way. What is it about that works?
Yeah. I mean, the extreme example of this is Julia Cameron, who is the queen of creativity. She wrote The Artist's Way.
Yeah.
And one of the things she tells everyone to do is start with this morning writing journal, you know, several pages, longhand, pen on paper. And I can't tell you that scientifically I have data that proves this. But I think it's pretty common that remarkable people are disciplined. And, you know, they're not all over the map. They're not like freaking out every day. And I mean, I'll tell you my habit. So my habit is I get up and I make one cup of coffee, pour over style, in my Melita filter. And I have one slice of wheat toast or 9-grain toast with peanut butter and a banana. I do that almost every day. And the beauty of that is that's just one less thing to think about. What should I eat? Where should I go? And when you see all these people who are CEOs and stuff, and they always wear black mock turtlenecks, or they're always wearing a hoodie. Yes, they probably are fashion challenged, but I got to tell you something. When you wake up in the morning, you say, put on my hoodie, go to work, or put on my black mock turtleneck, go to work. That's just one less thing to think about. And there are more important things to think about.
You write on this, rather than vacillate between about what to do first, you start every day with the same activity. The goal is to get in motion and save your brain power for important choices. So key. Speaking of brain power, one of the practices of remarkable people you've noticed is that they hire people better than themselves. And yes. I was struck by what you wrote about during your time at Apple. You write, the Macintosh division had a rule. You had to hire only A players, that is, people who were as good or better than the rest of us. And you add, that's evidence of arrogance for sure. Our thinking was that A players hire A players, or even better, A-plus players. And I was thinking about that, and one thing that's really wonderful about remarkable people, getting back to our distinction of what's they notice what's unremarkable about them too, and they're willing to find people who are better than them and work with them, and they make that work, and they've made peace with that, haven't they?
Well, they have. I mean, in fact, it's more than making peace. They see that as a viable path. That I think that if you're a manager or you're CEO, you should be able to look around the room at your meetings and say, you know what? Everybody here is better at their function than I could ever be, because the rising tide floats all boats. And I want to add a nuance to this A players hire A players or A plus players, because I believe I didn't fully develop the concept until about 2 weeks ago. So much of my, and that's long past the book deadline. So a lot of the first third of the book is about the growth mindset and how to acquire the growth mindset and perfect it and embrace vulnerability and learn from mistakes. But that implies that the growth mindset is something between your ears. It's in your head. But I think just as important is, well, the work of Carol Dweck is the growth mindset. Remember the name Mary Murphy. Mary Murphy is a protege of Carol Dweck. And her perspective and the value add she has brought is that it's not just your personal mindset. It's also the environment you are in. Because if you are in a growth mindset environment with a growth mindset, then you can really do well. But God help you if you have a growth mindset and you're in a fixed mindset organization where people believe that you are what you are, you cannot learn, you cannot be trained, you cannot gain new skills. You're either a genius or you're not a genius. And I don't think that is an accurate nor optimal representation of the world.
There was a saying that I heard in grad school. I went to grad school for organizational leadership and behavior. And one of the sayings was, if you put a good person in a bad system, the system will win every time.
Yeah.
And yes. I don't know if that's literally, I mean, there are notable exceptions to that. Gandhi, Jesus, you know, there's definitely some exceptions. But I think for a lot of the time, that is true. Who we surround ourselves makes a difference, a big difference. And it's one of the reasons you point out, too, that remarkable people interact with a diverse group of people. And in fact, you say their social media accounts are probably a window into their soul. You do really get a sense of a person just by looking at who they follow, who they're listening to, who they're connected with.
Yep. I truly believe that. And one of the things that frightens me in these recent developments is this anti-DEI thing that, you know, we're not supposed to teach about diversity. We're not supposed to teach about slavery. We're not supposed to teach Black history. And if you think about it, if you have everybody singing the same song, thinking the same things, you're setting yourself up for failure. You are going to be blindsided. And when you look at, if you're outside of a company looking in and you're thinking of joining that company, you absolutely should figure out, do they have a growth mindset? And the evidence of growth mindset is, first of all, diversity in their employees. Secondly, do they have learning and development programs? And third, ask the recruiter, you know, do you value growth and learning, or do you only value immediate results? In other words, are you trying to find geniuses who already know everything and instantly have results? Or have you come to the realization that people can become better and better? So you hire good athletes, I mean, athletes in quotes. You hire good athletes who can learn and develop and be better. And I'm telling you, you should look for those kind of signs. And if you really want to get a rise out of the recruiter, just ask the recruiter, is it all right to ask stupid questions in this company and see what he or she says?
Yeah.
And you know what? If I may add something, many of the people listening to this audience, they're the decision makers, right? They're the CXO level, and they either make the hiring decisions or they heavily influence them.
Yeah.
So you know what? Ask yourself, in this organization that I run, is it okay to ask stupid questions? Because if it's not, you need to rethink your position. Because I'm not saying there are no stupid questions, but a lot of simple, stupid questions lead to very good results.
Indeed. Guy Kawasaki is the author of Think Remarkable, 9 Paths to Transform Your Life and Make a Difference. Guy, thank you so much for your perspective and your inspiration.
Thank you.
If this conversation was helpful, 3 related episodes I'd recommend to you. One of them is episode 567, How to Lead and Retain High Performers. Ruth Gotian was my guest on that episode. She's done a ton of research over the years on high performers and how to work with them, how to lead them. Some of the most remarkable people that we're going to work with are the people that we lead. A lot of advice from Ruth on that episode on how to lead high performers well, because they are different than the typical employee. Episode 567 for that. Also, I'd recommend episode 525, How to Strengthen Your Network. Marissa King was my guest on that episode. We talked about the different kinds of ways that we all tend to build networks. And it turns out there's 3 really distinct kinds of ways that show up in the research on how many of us do that. And most of us tend to migrate to one of those preferences. And oftentimes we think about building a network and we look at lots of other people on how they're doing it, and we don't necessarily think about our own preferences and strengths. Marissa, in that episode, walks through with me some of the ways to think about that, how to recognize your strengths and how you build your network, and to lean in on that substantially. Episode 525 for that. And then finally, I'd recommend episode 644, Help Your Team Embrace Growth Mindset. Eduardo Braseño was my guest on that episode, and we talked about the importance, of course, of growth mindset, as most of us have heard and has echoed in Guy's work and in this conversation. But what we don't often think about is, how do we actually do that with an entire team, an entire group of people to support growth mindset there. In episode 644, Eduardo and I looked at how we can do that better, not only through our mindset, but also our practices and expectations with an entire team. If that's on your radar screen right now, a good complement to this conversation for sure. All of those episodes you can, of course, find on the coachingforleaders.com website. If you have not set up your free membership before, I hope you'll take a moment to do that, because when you set up your free membership, you'll be able to get into the library of all the episodes that have been aired since 2011 and to find what is relevant to you right now. One of the places we're filing this episode under is networking. We have had many conversations over the years, including the one I mentioned a moment ago with Marissa, but many others that'll be helpful to you, but lots of other topics as well. Full access inside of the free membership. In addition, also access to my book and interview notes. Every time I read a book, at least most times when I can get access to it, I am writing out the notes that I'm thinking about when I'm talking with guests, just as I did today with Guy. And I'm also capturing some of the most useful highlights from their book. In Guy's case, I've detailed out some of the key indicators for remarkable people, some of them that we didn't have a chance to cover on the conversation today. I've got those in the PDF download of my book and interview notes for almost every episode. It's one of the benefits of free membership. You can find that on all the episode pages, but when you log into your free membership, there's a whole section for book and interview notes. The entire library is databased there over the years of all of those I've captured for all the books and interviews in recent years. One of the key benefits of free membership. Go over to coachingforleaders.com, set it up. And if you're looking for more, a great way to get more perspective from remarkable people, because is to lean in more on our guests that are on this podcast. There's so many remarkable people who come on the show. I feel so privileged every single week to be able to have these conversations and bring them to you. And one of the things I love to do is be able to get our guests, experts, in conversation with our members directly. Every single month, our Academy and Pro members sit down for a live conversation with one of the guest experts who's been on the show in the recent past. We record those conversations and we make them available to all of our Coaching for Leaders Plus members. If you're a member of Coaching for Leaders Plus, you already get an email from me once a month with that recording, more details, and opportunity to really hear more from some of our guests. If that's something that's of interest to you, it's one of the key benefits inside of Coaching for Leaders Plus. To discover more, go over to coachingforleaders.plus. You'll find out about those expert chats and so much more inside of Coaching for Leaders Plus. Coaching for Leaders is edited by Andrew Kroger. Production support is provided this week, as it always is, by Sierra Priest. Next Monday, I'm glad to welcome NASA astronaut Mike Massimino to the show. He's going to be talking with us about setting the tone for speaking up, critical skill set for us to have in our roles in organizations. Join me for that conversation with Mike, and I'll see you back on Monday.